lid, but it's all so much more. It's the heart of the art form that we all adore. Your friendly neighborhood comic book store. Out among the stacks of new releases, browsing with your future new best friends, you're gonna find the book you love to pieces. The girl behind the counter recommends dollar books and shelves of graphic novels. Action figures, board games, toys, and models to add to your new Comic Wednesday haul. The comic book store, the comic book store, 'cause that's where the books live, but it's also much more. It's the heart of the art form that we all adore. Your friendly neighborhood comic book store.
Good evening. You are listening to Source Material Live. I'm your host, the Man Data Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And this week, we are getting into Stargirl, otherwise known as the Star-Spangled Kid. First up, we're looking at the 15-issue run on her very own book called Stars and Stripe, capital S-T-R-I-P-E. This was published in July of 1999, and as I said, ran for 15 issues, starting with issue zero. It was written by Jeff Johns, and it had art by Lee Motor and Dan Davis. This is apparently the book that got Jeff Johns' career going, so if you hate Jeff Johns and everything he stands for, blame this book and its relative success. This, of course, was the inspiration for the CW show Stargirl, which myself and Al Sedano will be talking about tomorrow on TV Party Tonight. In the meantime, to help me break down the first six issues of Stars and Stripe, ladies and gentlemen from the Cosmic Treadmill, Mr. Chris Sheehan. How do you do, sir?
Hey, how are you? Yeah, we're going to be talking about some very, very early Jeff Johns stuff here, and you know, without putting the cart before the horse, I remember enjoying this a whole lot more the first time I read it. So we'll play with it because it's quite a different experience, 20 years later. But
I was gonna say a lot can happen in 20 years. Taste change in 20 years. We were talking before the show started. It's a very like teen, preteen, juvenile kind of book. I think this would appeal to young comic readers. I don't know how well it appeals. I don't know how much it appeals to middle-aged men.
Yeah. I find it funny here. The first thing that stuck out to me, before we even get to the story, is the fact that, like, on page one, panel one, we get the announcement that Courtney Whitmore was created by Jeff Johns and Lee Motor. It's like you're not making Superman here. This isn't with a, you know, by friendly arrangement with the Schuster family or the Siegel family. This is a character that hadn't even appeared yet, but they're staking their claim and making sure people know this is my character. Do not copy, even though it is a derivative character. But
You read this when it was contemporary,
yes, or thereabouts.
Was it a popular book in its time?
No.
Okay. Nobody gave a shit.
No, it was just, you know, this came from a time where the late 90s and into the turn of the century, DC was just this hotbed of creativity and unique and novel and, with hindsight, sort of obscure books. I mean, you had books like Stars and Stripe. You had books like Chase, which was a wonderful book, which was not loved in its time. You had Young Heroes in Love, another really fun book that was not loved in its time. There was a new Kronos. It was just a major bummer was one. They had all these like weird things they were throwing at the wall. It was a very experimental time. I mean, this is hot off the heels of like the Marvel bankruptcy, the speculator bubble bursting. They were trying a lot of new stuff. So I'm happy that we got a book like this. And when I read it, it was a few years after it came out, but I really fell for it. I was a really big fan of the young DC characters. Young Justice was my top book. You know, the book I would read first every month was Young Justice. Loved it. Can't read it now, but back then it was my favorite thing going. This was right up there with it. You know, this was a fun book, and I really enjoyed it. And I appreciate the opportunity that you've given me to go back and revisit it just to see how my tastes might have changed. I did review a couple of these at Chris's on Infinite Earths, but not a big, you know, clump like we're doing today.
Well, we're going to start with issue number one, and the synopsis. I don't know if Jesse's tonight, so the synopsis is brought to you by Comic Vine.
Oh, and one more thing, though. Courtney Whitmore was actually inspired by Geoff Johns' own sister.
Really?
Who? Yes, she passed away. Were you on Long Island back in 1996?
Yes.
Then you probably remember TWA Flight 800.
Vaguely.
Okay, well, that was a plane that crashed off like the east coast of Long Island, or around the east side of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that monopolizing the news for days after it happened. And she was on that flight.
Wow.
Yep.
All right, so you've seen her in issue number zero. You'll be seeing her in JSA number one. But here it is, the origin and first adventure of DC's newest star. Freshly moved to Blue Valley, former home of Kid Flash, Courtney Whitmore learns a secret about her new stepdad, Pat. He was once known as Stripesy, the golden age sidekick of the original Star-Spangled Kid. And what better way to irritate the new dad by forcing him to be a sidekick again to her as the new Star-Spangled Kid makes her action-packed debut at Blue Valley High? All right, so right off the bat, you know, they show her beating up on the Dragon King, and there's a mystery afoot at this new school where kids are disappearing and turned into henchmen for the Dragon King, which I read through issue number six, and they never resolve that.
Nope.
Ever. they came close once. and I'm assuming as we get into issue 7 through 14, they'll eventually get back to it.
You'd hope. I don't remember off the top of my head.
But she just, you know, like, the kids are disappearing, they unmask two of them, and it's like, okay. And then she's distracted by the Young Justice and what they've got going on there, and we'll get to that. We'll get to those issues momentarily, but so this first issue, and I don't want to talk too much about the television show because A, you haven't seen it, and B, we'll talk about it tomorrow, but she's not nearly as contentious and bitchy to Pat in the television show. I mean, there's some definite "you're not my dad" stuff going on.
Sure.
But here, and I'll get your opinion on this, she is freaking rough with him, man.
Oh, she is awful. But, and it's funny you mention that. I was hoping you'd say something like that to give me an opening here. The first time I encountered this character was in JSA. You know, I was reading JSA as it was coming out. Then I found out about this book and I went back and I pulled it, you know. In JSA, she was like the consummate girl next door. She was and Geoff Johns was co-writer of that. So she was like this very wholesome sort of character, and was sort of the like conscience of the JSA. And then to come back and read this and see just what a horrible, like, snotty, bratty kid she is, it's a little off-putting if you're coming into it backwards. So I don't know when it gets resolved. I don't remember when it gets resolved. So maybe I'm guessing this must have happened before JSA, but it was very, very off-putting to come back and see her be quite this contentious and downright mean to Pat, who really doesn't mean her any harm.
Yeah, she spends a lot of the first issue like getting in trouble at school, mm-hmm. and of course the principal there is something. If I think he's either an alien or working with the Dragon
motor oil.
King,
yeah.
Something like that. But he's evil. But she like, you know, like she saves a girl from a bully, and she like puts her foot in his face. But then she's immediately like getting in trouble, and then she's like, she doesn't care that she's in trouble.
No,
you know, and her mom is trying to reel her in, and Pat's trying to reel her in, and she's like, no, you know, like like, in no way humble. Like, I understand she's supposed to be, like, a 15-year-old girl, and she just moved from, I guess...
90210.
Yeah, it was Beverly Hills to Nebraska, and look, I understand, you know, kids are hormonal, you know, kids can be angry, they, you know, and everything, but you have to get people to want to read this book, and I don't... Yeah. And this first issue, where she's just horrible to Pat, horrible to her mother, and not a particularly nice kid, or somebody I want to cheer for, it's a hard read in the beginning.
Yeah, she's churlish, you know? She's, mm-hmm. It's hard to root for her. It comes across as it's been written by someone who's never met a teenage girl before, because she's that hardcore.
Yeah.
She doesn't show any sort of regret, any sort of conscience. It's just, I'm an asshole. Look at me be an asshole.
Right. It's as if the impression is, well, all kids are terrible.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, but she's still got to be a suit. You know, like, I get, like, if you think about the origin of Spider-Man, you know, he starts off as an asshole, too. But
sure.
Very quickly,
he's made to, pretty quick.
Yeah, he's made to realize, I have to be better than this. I have a responsibility to the people around me to use my powers for good. And after that, he's just wisecracky. He's not a bad kid.
He's not mean-spirited. Yeah, and in his civilian identity, he's not a bully or a terror.
Right. Any more thoughts on this first issue?
What was that episode of Seinfeld? I think it might have been the Festivus episode, where Jerry was dating that woman who they called a Two-Face,
mm-hmm.
because in certain scenes she would look lovely, and then in certain lights she would look like a ghoul.
Yeah,
that's this art.
She looks like a witch in some of the. She looks like a witch in some of these drawings. Like she's supposed to be a hotsy-totsy, little attractive thing,
yeah.
And in some of these pictures, the way they drew her, she looks god awful.
She looks like a 45-year-old chain-smoking divorcee.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all the women in this, all the girls in this book look like, it looks like season 8 of Desperate Housewives. Just, like, rubbery faces stretched to oblivion and just permanent scowls. The art goes from being, like, really good to look at to just, like, whoa.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice for art.
Yeah.
To say the least. All right. Next issue. Again, brought to you by... And I love the villain in this. Paintball. Paintball Strikes. Stripe can only save the new Star-Spangled Kid from the Ultimate Terror if he can get his suit to stop conking out while he's flying 300 feet in the air. And what is Courtney's ultimate terror? Why, detention, of course. Also, the new villain called Paintball explodes all over Blue Valley High. So this whole, like, high school is infested by... teachers working for Dragon King or aliens or something.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of a fun issue. She get her and her friend Mary get detention, and the art teacher that gave him detention is also a supervillain.
Yes,
and he like steals your color. And it's one of those where like. This only works in comic books. This would never work in any other medium because this is so over-the-top silly.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of silly that I found entertaining. Like, I found Paintball more entertaining than I found Stargirl.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. 100%. It's just a unique sort of a look. I thought the power set was really neat. The look was super cool. Very like psychedelic swirly colors inside him there. It's basically a human shaped character with swirling colors. It's very, very cool. You could see that aspect of it working really well in live action. Just that aspect of it. But he is much more entertaining than Stargirl or Star Spangled Kid is in this.
In the description they talked about the suit, and so Pat built this robot for him to control, and he uses it mm-hmm. to keep Courtney from getting too hurt. In the show, they made it a point to say that she had done martial arts and she was a gymnast, and there was a base power set of fighter qualities that she had that was then amplified by having the Starman's wand.
Mm-hmm.
And here, they don't really get into any of that. She suddenly just becomes more powerful because she has this belt on, yeah. which I didn't love.
Yeah, the cosmic... What did they call it? The was it a cosmic belt?
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Let me see if I can find it here. Cosmic converter belt.
There we go.
Which they don't really explain what it does, and I think that's part of the mystery, because at some point they were like, they talk about it doesn't work for her the way that it worked for the Star Spangled Kid, mm-hmm. the original Star Spangled Kid, and that it was going to take, like, the cosmic converter is almost a sentient thing, and it has to get used to her.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always work when it's supposed to, and, you know, it's one of those things that I guess over the 14 issues develops over time. But early on, she doesn't have a tremendous amount of control over this. But like as I was saying, I don't love the fact that in the writing, they spend so much time with her just being a bitch that they don't really explain, you know, she put on the costume as, you know, to annoy Pat, mm-hmm. you know, and she took the, you know, she didn't know what the belt was going to do when she took it. This was all just to jab at Pat. And then suddenly she's like, I'm a superhero. Like, there's no real motivation. You know, it's just like, I like danger, and I like annoying Pat, and that's all there is to it. Yeah, which is not great writing.
Nowhere. Yeah. Now, that does come out of nowhere. The whole her just deciding that she'll be a superhero does... it feels very, very forced and very, very out of nowhere, for sure.
Anything else about issue two?
Not really. I mean, like you said, this is... There isn't a whole lot of meat on this bone, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of people are going to start maybe not a lot of people. A couple of people might discover this book after watching whatever the hell's on the CW. But I don't know if they'll get what they're looking for. Because
mm-hmm.
this is... there ain't a whole lot of meat to it.
Nope. Issue number three. What sucks more than high school in Blue Valley? The human mosquito called Skeeter. When one of Dr. Graff's experiments goes astray, it's up to the new Star Spangled Kid and Stripe to stop the overgrown pest from putting the bite on Blue Valley's blood supply. Plus a brief appearance by the mortal counterparts of the Marvel family in a prelude to this summer's explosive crossover event. Okay.
Which sucked.
What was it? The crossover
Day of
event?
Day of Judgment. Jeff Johns' first ever event.
Okay. What was so bad about it?
It was boring to me. It was a lot about the mystical characters of the DC universe,
mm-hmm.
and it ends, spoiler alert, with Hal Jordan becoming the Spectre. And Hal Jordan had been dead. You know, they go to whatever realm of the afterlife Hal Jordan's kicking around in, and he becomes the Spectre.
Oh, interesting.
Not really.
So that's where that happened, huh?
Yeah, that's where that happened.
So, did it seem like Shazam and the two other Marvel siblings were seriously underpowered in this episode, this issue?
A bit, but it also, I mean, the art here, it's worth noting that when we meet them, the first thing we see is them, like, trouncing, like, physically trouncing a basketball team, like, of teenagers.
Right.
And they didn't make it very clear in the art that it was a dream sequence.
Right. He's one of the Marvel siblings is saying that's what we should do.
Yeah, it's like, what in the heck?
Like, nobody's responsible with their powers at all.
Yeah, it's bad. but yeah, the Marvel family being in there, what are you going to do? But we do get Captain Marvel Jr. in his late 90s, his late 90s code name of CM3.
Is that what that was?
Yeah, because, they played with the joke throughout the issue because Captain Marvel turns into Captain Marvel by saying Shazam. Same with Mary Marvel, she says Shazam. But Captain Marvel Jr. says Captain Marvel to turn into Captain Marvel Jr. So the whole gag is he can't even say his own name without transforming back into Freddie Freeman. So they had to change his code name to CM3, which is, they could have called him so many other things. CM3. It's bad.
So bad. The big threat in this one is a giant mosquito called Skeeter. Which
it looks more like a morph.
Yeah. Well, they spray him and they kill him, and that's the end of that.
Yes.
not a lot here. All right.
No, not a lot.
Issue number 4. The Marvel family guest stars to help our heroes confront the Day of Judgment. Captain Marvel, Mary Marvel, and Sam 3 must help the new Star-Spangled Kid and Stripe as they face the threat of a revived Solomon Grundy in the heart of Blue Valley. Oh, yeah, I remember this. This is not the Solomon Grundy from the Batman comics. This is a walking, talking, thinking, zombie
this is
Solomon
like Mr.
Grundy.
Fix-It Hulk here. Yeah. I don't remember him being this eloquent or articulate with his speech, but late 90s DC was a weird place.
Yep. So this one was all about them fighting Solomon Grundy. She's getting better by this point. She isn't nearly as hard to read. And I think when I was reading it this morning, when I got to this point in the book, I was, you know, I just sort of accepted she was what she was and kind of went along for the ride. What did you think of issue number 4?
It was okay. It was better than most of Day of Judgment. Because Day of Judgment was very boring. I was really thrown off by the articulate Solomon Grundy, though. I don't remember that. I'm not going to say Geoff Johns made a mistake there because he was, you know, he was in charge of the whole event of a Day of Judgment. So it must just be something that I missed or just don't remember right.
Mm-hmm. All right, issue number 5. This is a 2-part issue with Young Justice.
Mm-hmm.
So, before we get into this, Young Justice was your book. What did you like about it back in the day? What made it so good?
It was just such a different kind of book. A lot of the books back then were, like the main superhero book in DC was JLA, which was like this, like you felt like you were really receiving something special with JLA, you know, at least early on in the run when it was like Morrison and Wade did a bit. It felt like the big budget book of the comic shelves. Really, it was the big 7 characters. It was just, it felt epic. They also brought back Titans with the, you know, the classic Wolfman Perez characters. You had, you know, Nightwing, Starfire, Cyborg. Everybody was back, so you had these iconic versions of the teams, and then you had Young Justice, which was just this weirdo. Should have been Teen Titans, but we already have a Titans team. And I've heard it described as like Young Justice is junior high to the Teen Titans high school. So you have like these kids that are in this, they're not quite kids, but they're not quite grown kids yet either. And it was just very, very charming. It was very, very funny. It was written by Peter David, I don't know if I've read anything by him that I don't love. Had art by Todd Knock, who was sort of like a manga influence, but with a lot of Western sensibility. So it was different looking than a lot of the stuff on the racks. It was different reading than a lot of the stuff on the racks, and it just had a fun cast of characters. You had Robin, Superboy, Impulse, Arrowette, Secret, Wonder Girl. Eventually, they'd meet a young version of Lobo that they'd call Slobo, and it was just such a fun book. That went away, as did a lot of DC's fun when Dan DiDio came aboard. But I remember it very, very fondly. Unfortunately, it was one of those time and place sort of books, so anytime I've tried to revisit Young Justice, it really doesn't have that same magic, unfortunately, anymore. But when it was there, I was all about it.
So they are very interested in who the new Star-Spangled Kid is. I think it's another dude. And,
yeah, they think it's a boy, yeah.
And so they come to Blue Valley to investigate. Now, which iteration of Robin is this?
This is Tim Drake,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
They come to Blue Valley to investigate and see who the new Star-Spangled Kid is. That's the boys on the team. The girls go into the swamp
yeah.
to investigate what's going on there. And as it turns out, the school, among other things, has been infested with aliens that, if they shoot you, turns you into one of them.
Yes.
And at one point, Stargirl gets shot with this ray, and even with her new braces on, which I thought that was cute. You know,
that was, yeah.
So she gets braces on in the beginning of this, and she keeps covering her mouth, and she's embarrassed and all of that. I'm like, okay. Of all the things that they've written about this girl, that was very true to form.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they shoot her with the ray, and that's part one of the story, is she turns into an alien. What'd you think of this first issue?
I think the first issue was a lot better than the second. It was neat seeing her meet Young Justice. Earlier on in the series, we see her like on her bed with magazines, and like she has like a Robin fan magazine. She's got Young Justice fan magazines, so you know she's a fan of these characters. And then when she gets to meet them, that was kind of cool. And like Superboy being like, "You're a girl," and she's like, "Well, yeah, you noticed." I thought that was kind of cute. I dug the interaction between them. I liked the fact that the boys were sent to the school and the girls were thrown in the swamp. I thought that was funny. And especially how Secret was enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I laughed my ass off at the way the boys were interacting. You know, like one of them's like, "Why do I get to be the nerd?" And you know, and all this other stuff. And then you have the girls who are all, you know, these are supposed to be big tough heroes, and they're all freaking out because there's bugs in the swamp, there's
mosquitoes and stuff. Yeah.
That was all funny stuff. The second issue kind of just wraps things up really quickly.
Very quickly, yeah.
They essentially... there's a bit where Pat, Mary, and I think Robin go to his basement, and they work on the ray gun, and then they reverse everything and send the aliens off and running.
Basically.
That's the whole story.
Yeah, and then, like, to infiltrate, they paint themselves green, and...
they wrapped it up really quickly and really easily. It wasn't a tremendous amount of tension there.
No, certainly not. Now, did this trade have issue zero in it as well?
I have the entire run as a trade.
It's an omnibus or an absolute collection or something, huh?
Yeah, it actually they changed the cover to the gal that plays Stargirl on the television show, but it's the entire run, including issue zero and some extra JSA stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I think they slot issue zero in between issue 8 and 9.
Okay.
Is what it says on the first page of Zero, because I read that first today, and it said, "We don't know where this goes. Slot it in between 8 and 9. So I'm like, okay, good enough for me.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave it to you then to tell us what 8 and 9 was all about. What issue zero was all about. Sorry.
Issue zero was a team up between Starman, Jack Knight, and Star and Stripe. And they were fighting Icicle, like Icicle Jr., I guess. Icicle was a Golden Age villain. This is a new iteration, perhaps related, maybe not. I don't remember. But this was framed by Jack's father. Have you ever read the James Robinson Starman?
No.
Oh, we might have some fill-in weeks coming up, right?
There's definitely one.
Okay, maybe we'll do some James Robinson Starman.
Okay.
Because that is a run that I think that's a run that would do any comic fan good to read. That's a wonderful, wonderful run. But it stars that Jack Knight who is in this issue, and his father, Ted Knight, not Ted Baxter from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but the Golden Age Starman. And this is framed by a narration by Ted Knight, who's talking about the first time his son Jack, or the last time maybe his son Jack met the old Star-Spangled Kid. And this goes very, very deep into DC history, because this goes into the Roy Thomas corner of the pre-crisis DC universe, which is a pretty wild thing to try to describe. And it's one of those things that used to be a purposeful blind spot for me, because it's just so very heavy and dense. I've tried reviewing some of these. I have reviewed a bunch of these books, but I wanted to do more of them, but it takes hours and hours and hours to review one of these, because it just relies so much on history, world history, comic book history. It's insane the amount of research that and love and passion that Roy Thomas put into series like Infinity Inc. and the Young All-Stars and All-Star Squadron back in the early 80s. Amazing stuff there. This Star-Spangled Kid that we're getting the story about here is the Infinity Inc. version of Star Spangled Kid, which is the that was comprised of like the children, the godchildren, the nieces and nephews of the Golden Age heroes. So that's where you'd have like Jade, you know, the Alan Scott's daughter. You had Obsidian, her brother. You have this Star Spangled Kid, and the meeting between this Star Spangled Kid and Jack Knight is very contentious. This is before Jack set about being a hero. He was just this like punk rock hipster dude who has an affinity for junk. In the series, he runs a junk store. So it's like he has like all these old trinkets, all these old toys, old movie posters, old, you know, film reels and stuff. That's just his thing. So he's in there arguing with his dad because his dad thinks he's wasting his life on junk. This perfect Star Spangled Kid is there, so Jack automatically starts just ripping into him for being a, you know, being a douchebag. And it's just a lot of that. But then we go into the team up where they're fighting Icicle at the zoo, and they ultimately, of course, win. But the framing sequence is where it's strongest, and that has absolutely very little to do with Courtney. But it comes down to it where Jack is, you know, kind of okay with Star Spangled Kid, and he even like suggests a new name for him because he doesn't want to be the Star Spangled Kid anymore. That Star Spangled Kid would go on to be killed by Solomon Grundy, because Jade in Infinity Inc. became friends with Solomon Grundy, but then we find out that it was actually the Harlequin and not Jade in a Jade disguise that did it. So it's a big, huge mess. Very, very deep stuff there. But the issue's okay. It's a pretty good issue. And I love the fact that it touches on so much lore. This is the sort of story that I lament the loss most when the New 52 happened, because these stories you didn't need to do, but when you did do them and they hit, they were wonderful to longtime DC fans or fans of DC history, because it recognized and respected that there was stuff that happened before. So stories like this that show that this universe is just like one big, you know, one big giant yarn ball where everything is kind of connected and everything reaches to something else. These are just wonderful stories to behold and to revisit. That, you know, I don't know what continuity is right now or if there's continuity right now. So for all I know, this thing's been removed 5 times over at this point. But it was fun to read, especially knowing, you know, the little that I do about the Roy Thomas corner of the post-crisis DC universe. It was fun to see it.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard from various comic people how the New 52 was just the most upsetting thing ever.
Dude, yeah. I was actually just... I was responding to some listener mail on X-Lapsed, where we were talking about loss of continuity, loss of history, and the different generations of fandom. And I remember on... it was Memorial Day 2011... there was the news all over all the comic websites saying DC is rebooting, you know, and everything's going away and everything's going to be brand new and Action Comics is not going to get its 1,000th issue. It's going to be number one. And it was just a very upsetting time. And what was most upsetting about it was the fact that there were so many people dancing on its grave. People were so happy that us old guys... And I mean, in 2011, I was at the ripe old age of 31. So us old guys were losing what we liked, because we were basically responsible for comics being in the pit. Unfortunately, we're the only ones that still pay money for comics. So
yeah, I was going to say, I think didn't DC shoot itself in the foot?
Several times over. With the New 52, they flushed 70-plus years of continuity, legacy, and love down the toilet to beat Marvel in the sales charts for like 2 months.
Right.
Like and 3 months into it, Marvel was back on top.
Well, I think both DC and Marvel at separate times made it a point to try to attract a new audience to comic books at the... Like, I'm all for trying to get new people to read comics, but not at the cost of your old, you know.
Yeah, don't cut your nose to spite your face, yeah.
And this is what happens with movies and television, too, is they look at the people who are paying, you know, the ticket prices or watching the shows and going, we don't want you. We already
have you. Yeah.
Yeah, we want this other group. And they really take the core
audience for granted, and then when nobody shows up and they wonder why their movies or television shows fail, they're like, what, you know, the new people never came and the old people tuned out.
And that's true.
That's the pattern.
Yeah, and it reminds me of another thing that Reggie and I did a show, a Comics Talk episode, where I took an interview by your friend and mine, Jim Cornette. He was describing the four types of fandom. He was talking about the four types of fans in wrestling. And he said, group one are the wrestling fans. You'll always have them. He said, don't shit on them, but you'll always have them. You have group two. They'll be there when the wrestling is good. So if they hear that there's buzz on something, they will come. You can't count on them, but if you make a good product and you keep making a good product, you'll get them. Group three comes for the big events. So they'll only be there for WrestleMania, or they'll only be there if Steve Austin shows up. If we look at it at comics, okay, well, these people will only come if it's a new number one. These people will only come if it's a civil war, a crisis of some sort, a big event. So you have one. When you're good, you get two. When you're lucky, you get three. Group four doesn't give a shit, and you're never gonna get them, so stop trying. Comics want group four. Group four is reading Harry Potter and the Twilight books. They do not give a rat's ass about if Superman's married or not, if he's wearing his underwear on the outside, if Wolverine is an old man or a young, little girl. They don't give a shit.
Right.
Don't try to get them. They're not coming. Group one you got. Group two you get when you're good. Group three you get when you're lucky. Group four ain't coming. And New 52, looking for group four. Marvel Now, looking for group four. Ain't coming. So very, very fool-headed. But of course, these things are dictated by people counting beans. So
sure. But know, they're also looking for like prestige. This is why Ms. Marvel, the trade for that mm-hmm. was like on the top of everyone, you know, every critic's reading list for a while. Like mm-hmm. There was a period where I was really trying to get my daughter into reading comics, and she does read graphic novels, but she's not reading the superhero type. She's reading other stuff.
Sure.
So half a score there. but I can't really keep her invested in the superhero stuff. Like, she tried reading Squirrel Girl, and she's like, I don't enjoy this. I'm like, all right, I give up. But like, I kept looking at, you know, because she's got this like feminist streak to her. I was going on all these different websites looking at lists of, you know, like top feminist comic books, and it was shit I'd never heard of, and Ms. Marvel.
You have Mockingbird, you have Ms. Marvel, you have the Winsome Wasp or whatever the frig it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the classics are classics for a reason.
Right.
I think you can give most kids who have a predilection towards comics, you can give them the first 20 issues of Fantastic Four and they'll enjoy it. You can give them Giant Size X-Men number one and they'll enjoy it. You can give them Amazing Fantasy 15 and they'll probably enjoy it. It's when you try to make it something that, you know, just like, you know, what's it, Squirrel Girl and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are just, they're very agenda laden. And,
you know, the only person I know who is a huge fan of Squirrel Girl is, yeah, middle-aged man.
And Reggie liked it too. Reggie liked it too. But I don't know what the I know why they're doing it, but I don't know the wisdom of doing that. I figure, you know, if you do want to put a message in a book, and I have no problem if you want to do that. It's your book, it's your pen, do whatever you want to do. Give me a good story first, you know? Maybe give me a story that I want to read, and then maybe inch in some, you know, some of your point of view. If you're giving me something I'm enjoying, I'll take what I want and leave what I don't. But if you're giving me shit, I'm just leaving.
Yeah, if your agenda is first and not the story, it ends up being a bad show or a bad comic.
Yep.
When the story is solid and there happens to be an agenda behind it, I'm not nearly as offended.
Exactly.
And I'm okay. Yeah. I'm actually, most of the time, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with people, you know, with getting an agenda out there, as people well know. But but you got to have a good story. So
that has to be meat on the bone. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, that wraps up our discussion of the first six issues, seven issues if you count issue zero,
of Stars and Stripe. Maybe if there's a second season of Stargirl, which I think it actually got greenlit for a second season, we'll revisit this and we'll do the last six or seven issues, of this and you know, wrap up the run. So we'll wait till then.
Works for me.
All right. What do you got going on in your neck of the woods, sir?
Oh, boy. What do we got going on? Over at chrisandreggie.podbean.com, I am still on my mission to have a new show out every single day for the month of September. And 28 days in, we've got 28 shows. So we're doing good. Right now, the almost daily show is X-Lapsed, where I'm reading a different X-Men book every day, working my way through the early parts of the Jonathan Hickman Hox Pox Docs era, House of X, Powers of X, and Dawn of X, and having a really good time with that. A lot of folks seem to be digging it and are reaching out, which is very, very new to me. I don't usually get feedback, so it's nice getting it. I appreciate it more than I can even put into words. So there's that. Me and Chris Bailey will be wrapping up the regular series of Moratori Monday this coming week. We have something very, very special planned for the final 31st final episode of the regular run. And then we got some stuff we're lining up for the rest of the run. We have six more episodes to follow, 32 through whatever, six is after 38, 37. So we have some stuff that we're lining up for that, some very special guests we're trying to get on the show and get a lot of questions answered about Strike Force Moratori. The greatest book you've never read is what they say. And what I say about it is it's the book that the internet loves to discover, but it never bothers to read, because people like to share it a lot and say what a great book it is, but when you ask them what they like about it, they don't have much to say. So, Moratori Mondays, X-Lapsed, the final episode of The Cosmic Treadmill, I'm still working on it. I'm still getting audio clips from listeners of the show who wanted to take part, so I'm still piecing that together, but that will be out sooner than later. The next episode of From Claremont to Claremont is about two-thirds of the way done, and it's just shy of 10 hours, so it's going to be a long show, but it is coming. I'm working on it just about every day, so that's that. You can find me on Twitter at Ace Comics, and all my stuff is at chrisisoninfiniteearth.com.
Well, Chris is going to be a regular on here on Source Material, but as I say that, he gets next week off because I'll have Alexis Haina on to discuss the true Amazon Wonder Woman, the true Amazon, and then the following week, Chris and Alexis, it's going to be a Wonder Twins team up, man. We're going to discuss the first four issues of the Lucifer run. It was collected in the trade Lucifer Volume 1, Devil in the Gateway. Or if you have Lucifer Book 1, again, it's just the first four issues, that story. And then on October 19th, Chris and I are going to look at both the 2018 and the 2019 Betty Page Halloween specials. That'll be fun.
I think so. That'll be right up there with... the hell was it, Warrior Nun?
Yes.
Battle Nun?
I'll make sure I make sure I record your audio this time.
I want all the nipple references to be in there.
Yes, actually extra nipple references. and then we will wrap up October with the death of Hawkman. So that's what we got going on.
I didn't even know he was sick.
That's what we got going on Source Material. Tomorrow, El Sedano from the Warlock and Thanos podcast will be on to talk about the television series Stargirl Season 1. And then on Wednesday, it was Tuesday, but it's now Wednesday because I am a glutton for punishment. We're going to review Clash of the Champions, Oos.
Oos. Recognize me.
Big Chief.
Smiling.
I'm the head of the table. I put food on the table.
I'll feed the family.
That's right. Good grief. Anyway, myself and the Podsman will do an afternoon show and we'll review Clash of the Champions. And then at night, myself and Jesse will talk about not EPMD, that's a rap group, but the metal band fronted by Overkill singer BPMD, American Made. It's their album full of covers. So Wang Tang, Booty Tang, whatever it's called. and many others. We're an American band. It's a great album. There'll be a lot of fun covers to talk about, so we'll do that on the Metal Hammer of Doom. And then October 1st, we're finally getting to it. It ended over the summer. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 7. We'll do a brief recap of...
Still going on?
It ended. We'll do a brief recap.
Like 5 years ago, right?
No, this past month or so.
No shit. Wow. Okay.
So we'll talk about the first 6 seasons briefly, and then we'll get into a full review of season 7. You can check out last week's shows in the archives. Jesse was on Source Material Live. We talked about Punisher, The Platoon. Myself and Robert Winfrey talked about everything, and then we eventually got to The Kingdom. We talked about all 3 seasons of that. And I was a naughty boy. I was naughty. And I got into a controversial thing. You can't even find it on the WTM website. It's so naughty. You can find it in the archives of the podcast, and you can find it on YouTube, but it's not even on the WTM blog page. I reviewed with Jesse, who didn't see the movie, but had questions that needed answers. Mignons, otherwise known as cuties. I've made many, many men uncomfortable with this. Many, many people. Because I am a controversial figure. So if you want to know
that's about those little oranges that are easy to peel, right?
Yes, it was about fruit.
I love it. Yeah.
Oh, all okay, the fruit.
I'm not uncomfortable anymore.
Okay. So if you want to hear me half-heartedly defend this movie and Jesse yell at me for 2 hours, then you've come to the right place. Check out our TV party for Mignons, a.k.a. Cuties. All right, folks, that wraps up this edition of Source Material Live. I want to thank Christine for being on tonight. Until then, be well, be safe, and behave.